Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Ben Rylan. On the show today, we're repeating a special edition of this week's edition of The Globalist, where we looked back at 2017 in books, music, and film. Culture editor Robert Bound is joined in the studio by broadcaster and DJ Georgie Rogers, film critic for The Telegraph Tim Robey, and publisher at Unbound John Mitchinson. So let's hand it over to them now.
Georgie, John and Tim, welcome to the programme. Ho, ho, ho and all the rest of it.
Ho, 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 ho.
Obviously, all our listeners are definitely sure that we've plucked you from your gift wrap, from your dressing gown Christmas mornings to be here. And don't you look great? And thanks for not getting changed.
Trains were a nightmare.
We're going to start the cinema, Tim. How many films do you think you've seen this
year?
That's
a good question. I reckon averages out to like 6 or 7 a week. But then there are more at festivals, so you add a few, then 50 weeks, kind of do the maths. It's probably between 300 and 400 in a year.
Wow. And so we're trying to boil it down. You've boiled it down, in fact, for one of our winter newspapers, but we're going to boil it down to two. A lot of darlings have been killed in the process of making this programme. So tell us first about the Florida Project.
Yeah, I feel as I've been banging on about this one for some years, but in fact, it was May that it premiered in Cannes. Made a huge impression on everyone and is now out in cinemas pretty much around the world and will remain so for a month or two because it's a big awards film now. Yeah. And this is the follow-up to Tangerine by the director, American director Sean Baker. Tangerine was the film he made on 3 iPhones down Sunset Boulevard about transgender sex workers. And now he's transferred his sights to this motel in Florida, in the foothills of Disney World, Florida. And it's about the inhabitants of this motel really living very close to the edge of complete poverty.
And there's something about the American dream here. This was kind of like, as you say, the spill out of Disneyland and the idea of the Disneyfication of America in those
days.
That's
exactly
what that means now.
And this little stretch of the 192, Route 192, going through Tallahassee, Florida, I think the director intends to kind of stand for a lot that's happened to America since the recession and the problems that a lot of people are in. This makes it sound like some sort of social realist, kind of Ken Loachy tract, but it's incredibly colourful and alive and rude and funny. And it's mainly told from the point of view of a 6-year-old girl, played by this newcomer, Brooklyn Prince. The director cast from locals, basically. The lead actress who plays her mother, he found on Instagram. The only name actor really with a significant role is Willem Dafoe, who plays the manager of the motel, who's the only one really keeping a roof over their heads and is endlessly long-suffering and patient about all their nonsense.
And nice to see him doing something that's kind of a little light-hearted.
I mean,
it's sort of
got heavy undertones, this film, but the kind of surface of it is extremely entertaining and vivid and kind of alive. And Willem Dafoe is so great in this role, and he's very likely to win all the supporting actor awards this year. He's already won quite a few of them, and he'll continue to because it's his time, I think. And so it's great to see him. But the other two actors are great as well. And I love the way the film is shot. It was the director really decided, look, I can make a proper movie. He shot it on 35mm. It looks
coming
fantastic.
From 3 iPhones, this is kind of like an embarrassment of riches, just having a camera, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. He wanted it to look really kind of picturesque in a way. And for that to be a counterpoint to the kind of poverty and the kind of serious subject underneath.
Well, let's have a clip from this so people can kind of get their bearings with it. And I'd say when the trailer comes on in the cinema, having been to the cinema a few times in the last few weeks, when this trailer comes on, it feels like such a good trailer. I guess you can tell that sometimes just how good a film is, the filmmaking, the storyline, some of the charming wonkiness of the characters and things like that. Anyway, here is a clip of The Florida Project.
Gets arrested a lot. These are the rooms we're not supposed to go in. But let's go anyway.
Could you give us some change, please?
The doctor said we have asthma and we gotta eat ice cream right away.
Here you go.
Hey, Lee, got a situation here. Open up.
It's only second week of the summer and there's already been a dead fish in the pool.
We're trying to get it back alive.
And water balloons thrown at tourists.
Mother,
Mom, you're
a disgrace. That is a clip from The Florida Project, a new from director Sean Baker, as recommended by Tim Robey. Tim, that's jolly, and it's got a sort of nice Little Miss Sunshine kind of soundtrack underneath it and all the rest of it. But How do you do sort of marginalised people with a light touch? How does Sean Baker get away with
it? He starts with the light touch and then he leads you into the serious story, and he does that very patiently. For an hour or so, it feels as though it doesn't have much plot. It's very episodic. It's just a summer in the life of this girl. But then it sort of starts to focus a little bit more on her mother's difficulties and on Willem Dafoe's character as it goes along. And social welfare people turn up and kind of cause problems. And it really gets darker and darker as it carries on. But by then, you're really hooked into the film, and the empathy of it has really kind of cast its spell. Both my fellow guests have said that they have nearly seen it now. And I really want to encourage people not just to nearly see it, but actually...
I watched the trailer though, and right, just the colours and the shots, every shot is painstakingly beautiful.
It's so beautiful, set that up
like the most amazing photo shoot ever.
The guy who shot it, the cinematographer, is really great. He's worked with a director called Carlos Regardas and made these incredibly pristine art movies. And now to have him transferred into this kind of American context is really cool.
Interesting times also to see a director's kind of work go, you know, make such a huge jump from one medium to the next and all the rest of it, from sublime to ridiculous or the other way around.
Yeah.
Okay, it's the Florida Project, much fancied by Tim Robey. Look ahead to awards season, Tim says as well, I think. Coming up now, The Work. Why don't we have a clip of this to sort of change pace, first of all.
Damn you!
That's right.
This whole process of going down into the wound is not an end in itself.
Is that what you do? Sit there and judge me?
I'll be trying. Nothing I can do or say, man.
We're looking for something, and we're bringing something back out of that descent.
Open your eyes.
You trust me? Well, let's step into that fear. Now's the chance to see what you got in there.
Simba.
Okay, so the margins portrayed in a fairly different way there. That is The Work from directors Jairus McCleary and Gethin Aldous. Tim, we heard a bit of primal screaming going on in there. It's set in Folsom Prison. Give us a little bit of what's going on around that.
So one of the reasons I've chosen this is that anyone could watch it right now if they choose to, because it's available to rent on YouTube and Google Play. It's a documentary that opened several months ago. And yes, it's about this group counselling session that takes place at Folsom Prison twice a year, where citizens from outside the prison come in and kind of commune and huddle with the prisoners and work through some of their emotional problems. And it's a very strange and ritualized process that they kind of submit to do this. But the effects are quite extraordinary. I think this is one of the most emotionally overwhelming films I've seen all year, because the guys in it, who are often these really troubled men who really have a lot of trouble dealing with their emotions and even kind of raising them, are encouraged to just kind of let rip and actually explain their demons and try and exercise.
And these are serious criminals. These are murderers and
that's right.
Rapists. But this isn't white.
Some of them are, yeah.
Stuff.
And some of them are lifers. And some of them are kind of, you know, former, you know, racist white supremacists who've kind of converted away from that. But the point is, it's a very two-way process. The citizens coming in, the film mainly focuses on three of them who have really buried emotional pain that they are encouraged to unlock.
And how even-handed are those filmmakers? Obviously, you set out, I presume you set out wanting to make a film that tries to get under the skin of these guys in Folsom, and also presumably tries to uncover why people go into the prison to uncover the demons that lay beneath these people.
That's right. There's not that much of an emphasis on necessarily the crimes that these guys have committed. It's more about things that they might have suffered in their childhoods, perhaps, which led them down that path. But it's about finding common ground with the non-criminals on the outside, who are also really struggling in various ways and have very different personalities. And one of them's extremely meek and doesn't really, you know, he seems this gentle kid, and you don't really understand what his problem is until very late on in the film he reveals it, and it's really heartbreaking. There's an extraordinary section as well where one of the prisoners explains that he's been cut off from his child and has no contact with him, and that his life is broken. He's really considering suicide within the prison every day. And the other prisoners are really trying to encourage him to give it a bit more time and to kind of talk to them and figure things out. And there's this moment where there's a lot of physical kind of clinching in this film. The kind of ritual process of going through all of this means that they kind of really, they rage and they rant and they kind of huddle together and scream and they try and let this stuff out. It really does produce results, as you can kind of see from some of the people who've been through it. But during one of these clinching moments, you hear the microphone and you hear this guy's heart beating incredibly fast because the mic's just on him. And, you know, I just lost it at several points during this film. It really is one of those kind of those films where male emotion just becomes really overwhelming. And it's a in this year where, you know, toxic masculinity or whatever we want to call it has been such a kind of major topic, I think this is the film that more than any other puts masculinity in kind of an arm hold, really, and really examines it and tries to understand it.
Amazing. And nice to have a documentary in your picks as well. Your top two.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's great stuff. It's called The Works, and so it's available. We can watch it right now.
It's there on the internet right now. Yeah.
If you thought your Christmas lunch was getting a little out of hand,
I'd say it's one for Boxing Day.
Maybe.
Not too light and fluffy.
No, exactly. Okay, Tim Robey, thank you very much indeed for your film picks. John Mitchinson, we're going to move over to you now for sort of your literary highlights of the year. Again, obviously so difficult to boil it down to a couple of things.
Yes, and it's been a great year.
A lot
of very good books this year.
And an interesting Booker Prize, I thought, as well.
Lincoln the Bardo, which I banged on about since...
I read it since after your recommendation.
Did you enjoy it?
I really did. Again, a bit like with The Work, I then reread it immediately.
Yeah.
And actually the second time I got loads more out of it.
It superficially looks like you ought to read it quickly because it's written almost like a play script. But actually the more you think about it and reflect on it and go back. So yeah, and that great new Philip Pullman, it was lovely being back in that world.
So some wonderful highlights. We're going to kick off with Priest Daddy from Patricia Lockwood. This is a really interesting concept. Tell our listeners
about it. I just smile. Even the title still makes me...
Yeah.
It's by a long way the funniest book I've read all year. I think it's one of the best memoirs in a way that I've ever read because it's so original. The premise is so mad. She is writing really a memoir of her father. Her father was an atheist who converted to Catholicism as a sailor on a submariner. On a submarine under the Pacific where he was forced to watch The Exorcist 72 times.
Wow.
As somebody said, the deepest conversion on record. He was married with children and he managed through a special dispensation of the Pope to become a Catholic priest, not just kind of religious. He kind of dominates the book, strides around the house in his underwear. He listens to sort of shock jock radio. He's taking and pulling apart guns and reassembling them all the time. He plays massively discordant electric guitar. As she said, never once does he actually play anything that's recognisable as a tune. It's just lots of licks. And the whole thing is mad. And her husband, who has been, they've been trying to run a kind of a small magazine, he gets a very difficult eye infection. He has to close the magazine. So they move back in their 30s to the family home, which forces her to reassess her whole life and her relationship with her father and her unbelievably long-suffering mother. He also drinks. He drinks kind of sweet liqueur out of tiny glasses. I mean, it's just almost an impossible creation. I mean, you know, you couldn't make anyone up. And she crowdfunds basically the money to write the memoir. Comes incredibly famous for a poem on Twitter called Rape Joke, which sort of goes viral. And then, I mean, she lands this book deal. But she's just an extraordinary writer. Every single page of this book, I think, has got...
Is this a debut, by the way?
It's a debut book. I mean, she's written a book of poetry before.
But this sounds like using up a lot of personal stuff.
Massive amount. Yeah. But you sort of don't mind because she writes about it with such... There's no judgment. I mean, it's an amazing book. She talks about being a bit of a kind of, you know, mad Christian. But she does... She you know, that story of a religious upbringing has been done many, many times. But nobody's made it this laugh out loud. Somebody called her the brilliant silliness of the story, which is great in one of the reviews. But I also loved her description of her dad early on as a loose, lazy pile of carnality, which is, they talk about, you know, they do have difficult conversations about abuse in the Catholic Church. He's very dismissive of her being a poet. He said, you know, poets are the kind of people who use low in conversation.
That's
but
brilliant.
I thought it was just, but there's a sort of the seriousness to it. The kind of serious theme to it is it's about family and how family affects. It's also about religion. She has an amazing scene where she's getting drunk with a seminarian, because quite often seminarians, young priests, come and stay in the house, and she's threatening to show her bare midriff, and he's literally doing the sort of
the
celibate block. She said, I've raised the celibate block. Her husband's... And there are so many great scenes. She said something that I really liked. She said, I know all women are supposed to be strong enough now to strangle presidents and patriarchies between their powerful thighs, but it doesn't always work that way. Many of us were actually affected by male systems and male anger in ways we cannot always articulate or overcome. So the sort of serious. It's in a year where
there's a bit of if I don't laugh, I'm crying kind of.
Well, I kind of in a sort of Me Too year, you know, hashtag Me Too this year. You feel that there's a massive amount of anger. But what she manages to do, she has that anger too, but she channels it into brilliant. The poetry is also hilariously funny.
And is there, can you see, we started off talking about Lincoln in the Bardo, George Saunders, poets that have gone to write wonderful books and incorporate some of that into the book. Is that the same with the Lockwood, with Patricia Lockwood here? We see the two worlds meeting.
Well, just in terms of her ability to turn phrases, I mean, she just, her descriptions throughout the book, obviously the father is a kind of a gift, as I say, but in her relationships with her husband as well, she's very, very sure-footed. It's quite difficult, I think, always to write funny. I mean, it looks like the easiest thing in the world. But when she sort of unleashes, there's an amazing passage. She's trying to describe, you know, the horror of her father's guitar licks. and she doesn't know, you know, she doesn't know what he's trying to do with the guitar, but she just knows that it's kind of is something weirdly to do with sex, and it's probably something to do with religion as well, that one of her brothers might actually be half guitar lick himself. And, you know, so I think, again, like anybody writing about their family, the quality of the book really for me comes from there's a tenderness there. I mean, she doesn't let her father off the hook entirely, but she doesn't judge him in the way he would be so, in a way he would be very easy to judge.
Yeah.
But she can see that in his mad, raging kind of fumblings after faith, there is something important. And she kind of shares that. I mean, if you want a proper, you know, guarantee if you pick this book up on Boxing Day, then you will be reading passages out and you'll, you know, tears will stream down your face. It is that funny.
It is Priest Daddy. It's by Patricia Lockwood. That's published by Alan Lane, as recommended by John Mitchinson. John, this has been wonderfully well reviewed. I read a few reviews of this one, The New Map of Wonder, A Journey in Search of Modern Marvels by Casper Henderson. This is your next pick. Talk us through this one.
I mean, he wrote one of the books with my QI hat on. Casper Henderson, one of the people we love the best. I mean, if you're trying to do make the world interesting but also make it intelligible, I don't think anybody writes as well as Casper Henderson in that vein. He's a kind of a philosopher, he's a scientist, he's a poet and artist. He draws on absolutely everything and weaves. His first book was a book of barely imagined beings, which was basically a book about very odd animals. It was a sort of highbrow companion to natural history television.
Yeah.
This goes even further. This is what we always used to call the ordinary mysteries, the things that we don't even think about. Well, they're so obvious. And yet, if you think about them even a little bit, and he's thought about them a lot in this book, they become even more strange and mysterious and wonderful. He says that the book looks into philosophy, history, art, religion, science and technology in search of a better appreciation of both the things we wonder at and the nature of wonder itself. So it's a philosophical consideration of what does wonder mean. That
he said to his publisher.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
But there's a chapter on light. There's a chapter on the heart. There's a chapter on the brain. There's a chapter on the whole idea of the self and of aging. There's a chapter on maps, the idea of how do we organise and lay out information in ways that are intelligible. It's a beautiful looking book, first thing. I mean, the Granter have designed it wonderfully. And with really lovely narrow text, and every now and then there's a bit that is in a lighter text, and there's a footnote on the side, and there's wonderful illustrations in it all the way through, albeit black and white.
It's a bit of a kind of boys' book of wonder from like the 50s about the layout of it somehow.
Just very elegant. But he goes everywhere. I mean, one moment, you know, it's the sex life of crows. Next moment, he's talking about the octopus, which is, you know, now protected as a species because they have emotions. And yet the octopus brain, he talks about the octopus brain. We split, the common ancestor of humans and octopuses lived 550 million years ago. So we can't even really conceive how an octopus's brain works. But he tries to do that. He's great at visualization, great at explanation. It sort of also ends up incredibly hopeful, which you would think. I mean, he doesn't shy away from the unpleasantness and the destruction that we're raging on the planet, and he doesn't. He's interesting about artificial intelligence and where we go. If you want one book that kind of sums up where we are in science and where we are sort of thinking philosophically of our place in the universe,
it's an amazing thing.
He's also, I've met Casper in Oxford before. He is a most delightful and unassumingly modest. And yet the book is really beautiful, and it's not difficult to read. I mean, it's a book I could give to my teenage sons, and probably will, if you're listening, for Christmas.
Well, luckily it's happened already.
Of course it has, yes.
When I was listening to one of your backlisted podcasts, John, when your guest was Alex Preston, he chose Charles Spronson's Haunts of the Black Masseur, which is a book all about water and swimming and man's relationship with water and challenges to and by water and all the rest of it. And I think you asked him whether I think you described it as a very much a pre-internet book, because there are books that can be written simply by Googling it, and then there are books that are written on that have a very different seam of knowledge that has been mined. This seems like the latter, I guess. There's a difference between the two, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's got one of the things about it, I love a good bibliography, and he's got a great bibliography, so lots of good books in this. I think he could... You'd be hard pressed, I think, as a single human being, to have covered the range of knowledge that this book covers, and not to have taken, you know, sort of 30 years to write it without the internet. But having said that, he is, like I say, it, just in the terms of its as a piece of technology in and of itself, and the way it looks, and the way he's written it, and the way he's linked and themed it, and put in illustrations, it's very much, you know, it's a lovely, lovely book. As a book, you know, so it's the best of the internet, repackaged for the person who wants to sit on the loo or just gaze out of their study window and understand the world around them.
I like that it's got wonder in the title. It's A New Map of Wonder: A Journey in Search of Modern Marvels by Casper Henderson. It's published beautifully by Granta. And before that, John chose Pre-Study by Patricia Lockwood, and that is our 2017. In truncated form in books. John Mitchinson, thank you very much.
Indeed.
Waving her musical flag at me to come up next is Georgie Rogers. Georgie, lovely to have you here. On Christmas Day, no less.
I know, things I do for you.
No. Again, we've got you to choose just two records of the year.
So hard.
I know, I'm sorry. first one is the newie, the oldish newie now from Feist. Tell us, is this a return to form from Leslie Feist?
Yeah, I mean... For me, I've always kind of been across her stuff. You know, she had those big pop big hitters, My Moon, My Man, and 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, aware. But this album just did something to me. It so beautifully captures a vulnerable, broken, fragile heart. Like, it's a breakup album in its purest sense. The highs, the lows, the grieving, the missing the other person, the wishing that you didn't miss them anymore, that kind of thing. And it just, it kind of broke my heart and mended it repeatedly every time I listened to
it. Well, that
is
a great recommendation. Both the gravel drive and the Savlon.
Exactly. Because it kind of sheds light.
As no one will ever write on that poster.
That's very good.
There's a quote.
To stop me ruining your wonderful treatise on Feist, shall we have a clip?
Let's
have a bit of... This is Feist with I'm Not Running Away.
I'm not making this up.
From Feist, it's called I'm Not Running Away, from the album Pleasure As Chosen by Georgie Rogers. It's one of her albums of the year. It takes a lot of confidence to play with that little accompaniment, and she's got such a voice.
She does. Yeah. She's got such an amazing voice, and you know, it's kind of bird-like at times, but then on this album she's channeling early PJ Harvey in quite a lot of it. Some of it really packs a punch. The whole record is so raw. It kind of sheds light on the rebuilding process, I guess, after the breakdown of a relationship, and that could be quite melancholy and droll, but it's just not. It's hopeful and beautiful and raw and from the heart, and the vocals are stunning all the way through. The melodies are just stunning all the way through. It really feels like an album as a whole piece of work. And I went to see her perform at Shepherd's Bush Empire, and it was one of my favourite shows. It really kind of, this whole album and the whole Feist thing had just kind of took me by surprise. It was a 6-year gap for this.
It's rare when people kind of come back and you go, God, I kind of had their records 5 or 6 years ago, but suddenly this is amazing.
Into it, for this, it completely knocked me off my perch. Literally, that her show was amazing. Her banter was hilarious. She looked amazing. The band were amazing. She played the whole album and then did some of the kind of amped up versions of the older tracks. And everyone was on their feet. There was a stage invasion, everything. You know, it was just a really amazing. Jarvis Cocker went on for his cameo.
So he's got one of, he's, on he duets one of those songs.
Yeah, he does
it?
A kind of poem on time.
It's been on since music, hasn't it?
Yeah. But I just feel like with this album, you know, she's totally bared her soul, which I think is quite daring. She kind of eschewed the poppier roots for something that is quite unpolished.
She had quite a moment,
brave,
didn't she, where she could, after 1, 2, 3, 4 and things like that, and that was used on a mobile phone ad or something similar, she could have gone very
she could
pop.
Have.
And I guess she probably had a record company gave her that choice and she's chosen something else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I just don't understand why this album isn't on all of the album of the year lists. Rolling Stones put it in theirs and Drowned Sound put it in theirs. And I think it, you know, it's critically well received. But for me, this album is stunning.
This has a lovely album cover. This is an album that looks pretty good on vinyl.
Bougainvillea.
Yeah, it looks like, and I'm trying to remember the name of the department store in LA, but it is. I'm sure it's the wall of. But it's a beautiful thing, isn't it?
And then there's a door, and she's in a pink suit, leaping into it, and it says pleasure. Yeah. It's a pleasure. It's a beautiful
record. It's a lovely thing for a breakup album.
Yeah.
For it to be called that and look like that, yet sound like that.
But it is kind of a pleasure to listen to. It's weird. But I mean, I love miserable music, so for me, this is right up my strata.
Savlon.
Yeah.
Okay. It's beautiful. That's the title of her next record.
It is Pleasure by Feist, the first album of the year, as chosen by Georgie Rogers. St. Vincent's Mass Seduction, or Mass Education, as I've been reading it as wrongly all year.
Yeah, no, definitely Mass Seduction. Yeah, she's a master choice. Of it. Absolute master of seduction on this album. The whole thing is so seductive. And Annie Clark is just a total genius, in my opinion. Another kind of pop powerhouse, in a way. You know, Feist was and has done something different. With St. Vincent, it's kind of gone the other way. She's really kind of harnessed her pop sound, but while still, it's still kind of razor sharp. Annie Clark being amazing. She's sort of, you know, the usual shredding of the guitar she had.
Very
made.
Angular stuff. It's
yeah,
all very,
it's still
I mean, that
jerky
was her kind of
cool,
signature thing, her kind of very... kind of jerky kind of new wave kind of stuff and then this has got pop laid over
it has place. Definitely it's got a bit more pocket poppy, but it's still completely, I mean, it's still, there's no tracks on this that let the side down. It's a consistent listen from start to finish. Gorgeous hooks. She worked with Jack Antonoff from Bleachers, and he was also in the band Fun, so I think he maybe kind of helped her bring that slightly poppier element
the
into
melodies
it.
And the tunes
in terms of just making it kind of a little bit more punchy, a little bit more catchy. I heard that he told her to write lyrics that you'd want to get tattooed on you. That's
a good one.
Yeah, which I liked. I like that. But yeah, there's like, it's really varied. There's big moments, there's vulnerable moments again.
There's a breakup album
also,
feel about this as well, right?
Maybe a theme developing.
George, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. Breakup was 2 years ago. Get over it.
Georgie's funding the tissues from her bag. While she does that, we're going to play a little clip.
Sad music is just better. It's just demonstrably true.
Yeah.
There's John's tattoo. This is Saviour, St. Vincent. But then you say, please. Then you say, please. It's Saviour, new from St. Vincent, from the album Mass Seduction. I almost called it Mass Education there. What is wrong with me? Look at the album cover.
It does look like it's like a trick.
I just skipped the missing A.
I'm just subbing it as I go, you know. And how
but
do
maybe,
you...
But maybe, so somebody should release the Mass Education album.
Exactly. The B-sides. The boring B-sides. The happy stuff, maybe, rather than the sad stuff. I like that. That's an interesting thing, as John said, that sad music is demonstrably better.
Yeah.
I mean, there are obviously the great, there's Blood on the Tracks, all the great kind of breakup albums and things like that. Where does this one, where do these guys sit in that canon?
She had these like big high-profile relationships with Cara Delevingne and Kristen Stewart, and that sort of seemed to thrust her into the sort of tabloid news world, which she was never in before. And so on the record, there are some of the out-and-out kind of ballads, love ballads. New York is one of them.
That's
she picks up the kind of story of of this mysterious Johnny and happy birthday, Johnny. There's lots of reflections on love for sure. But it's also, the album is also about sex and power and drugs. There's a track called Pills, which is kind of wildly neurotic.
That's a proper, and that's such a good New York party song as well.
Yeah.
It feels like it could have been written in New York 20, 25 years ago.
Exactly. Like so. There's bangers on this album. There's, you know, and it's just impossible not to get completely drawn in by the visual look of it. You know, playing on this, on the title of it being seducive, the cover, the videos, it's surreal, it's sexy, there's loads of PVC and hot pink and orange and pastel colours and real life swans and fire.
She does everything with a lot of chutzpah, right? Yeah, there's people that kind of, you feel, are faking this kind of art house kind of gone big time thing, and then there's people like her where you believe her every step of the way, and I'd put Feist in that bracket as well. Those people you just believe in what they do, so when they come out with a really poppy song, it's a good pop song. When they come out with a heartbreak record, it's got some balls to it, or some you know, some gravel down there in the bottom of its right as well.
Yeah, like Annie, I mean, Annie is just the consummate artist, really. Everything she does is kind of a piece of art. I think that's how she sort of approaches it. She's very, very clever. Everything's kind of perfectly formed in this aura and visual package, and that's why, and she does, you know, this album is from start to finish. Like, I press play it in the first track, listen to it all the way through, press, you know, and again, you know, on loop, and it's exhilarating and beautiful and powerful, and I just think a really amazing thing for young artists to look up to know that you can be different, you don't have to just fit the commercial pop mold, you can be an alternative artist and it be amazing.
It is Mass Seduction from St. Vincent. And that brings us to the edge of Georgie Rogers' picks. Thank you very much indeed to Georgie, to Tim Robey and John Mitchinson. To recap, they picked the films The Florida Project and The Work. The books were Pre-Study by Patricia Lockwood and A New Map of Wonder by Casper Henderson. And of course, Georgie picked St. Vincent's Mass Seduction and Feist's Pleasure as her albums of the year, and they are all available for your New Year gifts, maybe, or last minute things for people that come around on like the 27th of December. To play us out today is one of my favourite songs of the year, which takes me back to dancing in Tel Aviv. This is Gul Albi by Aiwa.